Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic lever it's supposed to be.
I had a great conversation with Brian last week. I'm just really loving your book. I love what you're doing at Danaher, and I love this whole concept, which I feels like it's kind of a new concept. So I'd love to spend some time kind of talking about that, how you kind of got into this game. And I'd also love to kind of make this a COVID episode, because I think this is a real opportunity for organizations to kind of step up and live out the things that they claim to be living out.
Definitely. Yeah, the book actually got picked up in Entrepreneur last night. They ran an article on the 8 books to read during the epidemic that will help you grow.
Oh my gosh.
It came in at like number 3 of the books you should read. And
how awesome is that?
So, I mean, it's been so hard to pitch media during COVID to get any sort of publicity. And I think your sense is right. There's an opportunity. What we're seeing is organizations, the line is just totally blurred between employer brand and consumer brand. And your employer brand and how, what you do now is going to define your brand for decades to come. And we're using our consumer purchasing power to stop buying products and services from companies that aren't treating their people well right now. And the people who aren't treating their employees well right now, the list is huge.
I know.
The articles are huge. I don't know if you saw the article that what Bird did with their associates, how they did their mask.
No, what did they do?
An article that came out. They had several hundred people into one Zoom call. They had no idea why they were dialing in. And it was completely different sort of behavior than any other call. And it took forever to jump off. And then some like really crazy voice they didn't know came on and they masked laid off.
Oh my gosh.
The majority of their workforce, like, today's your last day, you're done, da da da. And people are just so blown away by it. And then all the stores on High Street, there's now a rating, good, fair, or bad, whether how they're treating their associates, and they're published so that people know whether or not they should buy their products or services. So it's never been easier to see what people are doing and the backlash against them. And I think 2 things are going to happen. I think candidates you hire in the future will be asking you how you treated your people during this time and what you did to protect their well-being and safety, and use that as a determining factor whether they join you. And I think the people who aren't being treated well right now will leave in droves as soon as new opportunity emerges.
Right.
Because you'll never forget how you feel.
Yeah. To go from this, I mean, this was like a time of like tremendous prosperity over the last several years, right? Like everything was just up and to the right. And then for, you know, I saw this little video of this guy on a bike, and he was riding really fast right next to the beach. And then he kind of veered his bike onto the sand and he just immediately just crashed. And that's what it feels like happened here. You know, the power shifted from the job seeker, you know, when there was really low unemployment and, you know, really, really fluid labor markets and people could get a new job very easily. And, you know, employers were having to pay up. That has flipped so quickly. And along with that flip has come with, a ton of anxiety and a ton of worry and a ton of like insecurity around just, you know, the 2 things that everyone's scared about, right? Poverty and like death. Those things have crept into everyone's mindset. And these organizations that a lot of people have been very loyal to and put their heart into and have become sort of their family away from their family, to be treated as like a labor unit or a dollar or as a line item on a spreadsheet, after all the words that a lot of organizations I think have picked up on over the last, you know, decade, that, you know, people matter and all that other stuff. Those things are very easy to say, but when it comes down to it, you see what they're really made of. And I think you're right. I think people will never forget how they feel during this time.
Yeah. It'll be like 9/11. You remember exactly where you were. You'll remember exactly where you were working, exactly how you felt, and what was going on. It's all playing out on social media for everyone to see.
Right.
And because there's so many examples of companies that are getting it right, when you're at one that's not, it feels so much more painful.
Right. Why do you think that, you know, this thing on High Street where, you know, good, what was it, good, bad, okay, or something? Like,
yeah, good, bad.
This blending of, like you said, the sort of public brand and the employer brand, that line between these two things is kind of dissolving. What do you think is spurring that on? Because 10 years ago, nobody talked about this.
You know, I've been saying that this is the year of employer brand for like the last 6 months. And what I used to say was that because the economy was, the labor market was so low and unemployment was so low, I'm sorry, the labor market being so tight and the competition for top talent, we had more choice than ever as workers. So in our list of criteria and attributes that were really important to us, we could afford to be way more picky. And what we were seeing for the first time is people caring more about the people behind the brand than the brand itself. So if you think about employer brand versus consumer brand, you know, if your coffee beans aren't sustainably sourced, we're not going to drink your coffee. If you don't treat the people who are working in your factory well, guess what? We're not going to wear your shoes. We've seen that power shift. And I think it's because we have so much choice or had so much choice that we started to demand more and care more about the sustainability and the people behind the brand. Now with this, it's become so real where you see your friends and your loved ones, you know, get whacked with an epidemic, but then we have really high expectations of how especially big, large, successful corporations treat people. I don't think anyone's holding the small businesses as accountable. But we look to the large global players to really do right. And when you see them disappointing you on a grand scale, you've got to respond the only way that you can with your wallet.
Right. That's an interesting thing that you just said, that this was going to be the year of, you know, employer brand. And I think that's playing out. I think you're right. I think this is going to be the year of employer brand, but for some reasons that maybe we didn't anticipate because nobody really kind of saw this coming. And on the one side, it was going to be because, hey, there's this plethora of choice and guys really have to differentiate themselves by the way that they treat their people and so forth. And it's really kind of showing up in this scenario by how they end up treating their people in the context of scarcity, in the context of, you know, a downturn or whatever this thing ends up turning into.
Yeah, and I think before your brands were a bit protected from it, unless it was an active job seeker going to Glassdoor to see what you were like on your worst day. Now it's playing out for everyone to see, and we don't even have to go and seek it out because we're interested or exploring you. We're just seeing it because people are all using the only power that they have if they're in a situation where they're treated poorly, and they're getting a lot of support from the masses because we're so disappointed. There's also so many examples of people doing it right, and those brands are really rising in the ranks. And I think those are the ones that are using this as an opportunity to build affinity, to build connection, to show how much they care in a way that will also be remembered. I mean, I saw a post going around yesterday about people celebrating brands that they're just so proud of, how much they're giving to the fight and how much they're supporting their people. And there was this growing list of one of my coworkers, her daughter or her son works restocking shelves at Home Depot at night. And she commented on all the things Home Depot's doing, extra pay, extra medical benefits. If you get COVID, everything they're doing, the money they're donating and the products they're donating to other organizations. And she was just beaming about it. I think there's small examples like that. And then really grand examples of mass donations and people really getting involved in the fight.
It's just an interesting thing. I have a friend who works for a really large hotel chain, and they're on the other end of the spectrum. The way that they've treated her is just unbelievable. And, you know, I don't know if 20 years ago, if the same thing happened, I would just be like, oh, well, that's, you know, that's life. But I just have such a visceral reaction to this company now. Like, I will never stay in their hotel. I will never have anything to do with this company again, because of the way that they're treating my friend. I see the stress that it's created for her. I see the, you know, it's public information. You know how much the CEO made, you know how much, you know, how much stock they bought back, you know, over the last year and stuff like that. To just treat people as expendable in this economy, which is a knowledge work economy, which is a people economy, It's just really, it's really baffling. And I think you're right. I think we're going to see this massive separation between kind of the good guys and the bad guys, the companies that quote unquote get it, get the thing that you're talking about, which is employer branding, and get the fact that their people are truly an asset, they're not a liability. That human capital versus human resource kind of shifted in thinking. And I just wonder though, what is the runway for that? At what point will someone say, you know what, you know, because you can't continue, like for a retail store, for example, they can't continue to pay somebody, like if this goes on 9 months, can they continue to keep those people on for 9 months? I'm just trying to do like a little thought experiment. So if they can't, at what point when they start to lay people off, will we as the public who are tuned into this kind of thing be like, okay, well, I get that. Or the other side be like, well, that's not enough. You're not insolvent yet. You're not bankrupt yet. That's the line. I don't know where that line is. What do you think about what I'm talking about?
I think people just crave in times of uncertainty. So if you feel like you're getting side swipes and you're out of a job and you didn't have any runway or any notice, or you don't have visibility into a company's financial situation or how long you can last, it's going to feel and taste a bit different than if your CEO is being really transparent. Say, okay, if everybody takes a 20% salary cut, we have enough money in the bank to last 6 months. If it goes on, and then if you're also inspiring and rallying your people, say, here's what you can do to help. Here's something that we can all do, sheltering in place, working virtually to help the success of the company. It also allows you to rally your people and have people really get behind and help you in the fight, not just be passive to what's going on. I think it's all going to come down to communication. And the more communication that you have, even if it's largely personal, you know, when you're isolated, I think it's more important than ever to just really keep in touch and to be more open and transparent about what's going on, because you feel really disconnected. And the companies that do that, I think, will have more rally and support. And it's been really nice to see companies that have let people go. There was a company that let a ton of people go this week. I forget the name of it, but literally everybody that left that company was on LinkedIn yesterday talking about how much they love this brand and how loyal they are to this brand. And the head of HR is talking about all the great talent that just hit the market and if they can help them get jobs. And to see people get laid off and still be beating the drum to why your company was so great based on how they were treated, that's very possible. We're seeing examples of that. We're seeing companies really lean into their alumni networks right now and help former, like HubSpot, former HubSpotters now have this alumni network where HubSpot is actively helping them in their job search if they got laid off at a secondary company.
Wow.
And those companies aren't doing it for the brand and the PR moves. They really do have a people first mentality, but because they're doing it, that affinity is just, it's there for everybody else to see, and they're role modeling how to do this right.
Yeah, that's a really powerful thing, to lay off a bunch of folks and those folks feel like they were taken care of, or that, you know, it probably was rooted, to your point, in like good communication. And it's probably not this chicken and egg thing. It probably, you know, it probably wasn't at the top, you know, viewed as an opportunity to like, okay, hey, let's kind of play this from a, you know, a public branding perspective. It was probably the offshoots of some genuine sort of authentic care, to your point, of the people. And that just carried through this particular tragedy. And there was probably clear communication and transparency and authenticity around the vulnerability that these people were feeling at the top and so forth. Because you can't really fake that. You can't throw people a couple of bucks and say, you know, make sure you go on LinkedIn and don't wreck the company. You know what I mean? Like, that's going to come from an authentic place.
And I think the other thing with the hotel thing, I mean, they've been hit so hard and they've laid off hundreds of thousands of people. I think Hilton and Marriott numbers of their layoffs were pretty staggering. And that's a hard thing to do, but it's even harder to rehire that many people when the economy bounces back. They're in a position of extreme vulnerability, in my opinion, based on how they're treating people now, whether or not they will be able to re-recruit that number.
Isn't that interesting? There is, to kind of have this clear, authentic communication without sort of vulnerability communicated along the way makes it artificial and false, right? There's no real connection there. And so by avoiding that vulnerability or that fear or whatever that's preventing that communication, it ends up creating a real business vulnerability on the back end when we emerge from this thing. So it's like the vulnerability is going to be in the equation at some point.
I mean, vulnerability is probably the most vulnerable emotion, but people are so scared of showing any vulnerability personally in relationships, and I think professionally even more so. But those that do, I think they find, just as you probably do if you've ever opened up to your wife after feeling like, you know, you wanted to keep something bottled up, it just bonds you. It makes us all human. It's what connects us.
Right. Why is it so hard? You think it's just that fear of shame that is the downside of the vulnerability or something?
I think it depends how you were raised. I was raised in a house with two very powerful business executives, and neither one of them was ever wrong. I never heard them ever say, I'm sorry, or admit a weakness. It was just this constant projection of strength. I get a lot of poise from that, but it took me years to learn how to say, oh my gosh, I was wrong. I totally should have handled that differently because I never saw a role model. So I can't speak for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But I think people that see it demonstrated and role modeled in their households are in a lot better position than the ones that aren't.
So you know, I don't know you well, but you come across as somebody who kind of has both of those pieces. You obviously have that poise, but you also come across as somebody who's very authentic and very genuine. And I wonder how important that has been in your role at Danaher, pushing this employer branding thing. How has that kind of resonated, and how have those perspectives given you tools to make the impact in your company that I think is a pretty special organization?
It's such a special role when you get to take, you know, I've spent my career working at Fortune 500 companies that nobody's ever heard of and helping them raise their profile as being an exciting, great place to work. And I think in the earlier years, you know, I fell victim to the traditional way of employer branding, which was this one-way broadcast of strengths, which is very much void of the vulnerabilities or the expectations and the harsh realities that we really want our associates to embrace to be able to thrive within our walls.
Mm-hmm.
Having done that a couple of times at what I thought was really great results, what I learned a couple brands ago was that we actually ended up just overwhelming our funnels and drowning in application volume. And a lot of the applicants were unqualified. But because we had really seduced people with the sizzle of why we were a great place to work, we were rewarded with tons of apps. And I remember the heads of TA coming to me and being like, what AI products are out? What can we use to filter these, you know, these apps coming in? We can't even handle it. So when I went to my next brand, I knew I wanted to do something differently, and I wanted to prove that it was not only possible to use employer brand for attraction, but to use it to better qualify, reduce the volume, but also increase the quality. And that's when I met Brian and his organization, PH Creative, and we worked together. And he really taught me that the missing piece to the equation was adversity. And it's not a one-way broadcast of strengths, opportunities, and benefits. That doesn't mean much if it's not coupled with the adversity of what it takes to thrive here. You know, we all have these inward and outward motivations that we want to solve in most things in life, and it's no different when it comes to our career. Of course, we want to progress and move forward in our organization, but we also want to know, am I good enough to get in there? Do I have what it takes to thrive? And most of the time, we don't answer that question. And if we're trying to size up, if we can survive somewhere, there's no way we can answer that without knowing the size of the struggle. What are we going to embrace? What is it like, of course, on the best day, but what's it like on a bad day? And what am I going to feel like? And what support is going to be around to help me navigate those waters? And the nice thing about employer brand and humans is that our threshold for adversity is different. Some people will encounter the message and say, the hill is way too high. I'm not interested in going on that journey with you, but they'll appreciate and respect you for letting them know and, you know, not having them find out after making a major life decision or career move, et cetera. And somebody else will encounter that message and say, all right, that hill's sufficiently high, I'm in, because they're turned on by the challenge. So the very same thing can turn one person on, the other person off.
Right.
And Ben and I argue in give and get that that's exactly what we want. We want to polarize our audience. We want to put them to a test where they can make a decision about what they get in exchange for what they give. And that's a really beautiful thing, because we're pairing a strength with what you get in return. And there's a give in there that you have to be prepared for. And then what we see is a workforce coming in that aren't caught off guard when there's a tough day. They're ready, willing, and able to embrace that.
And so what are some things that you put in place to create that sort of polarization on the front end and steer away from these sort of great results you thought you were getting, which are really just a broadcast of a bunch of strengths, as you said, to really try to incorporate some of that salt with the sweet or something?
Yeah, so it's all about a well-matched give and get. So really what we do on the front end is a bunch of research. And our favorite question to ask employees is, if it was your job to convince someone not to work here and you couldn't lie, what would you say?
This is what you ask your current employees.
Yeah.
And do you ask that across the board? I'm not saying from a rank and file perspective, but I'm talking about from a performance perspective.
So this would be more in a one-on-one interview or perhaps in a focus group where you're doing some persona work. At the quantitative level, when you're doing your survey, you would probably ask more along the lines of like, what attributes do you think make someone most likely to succeed here? What do people who don't succeed here have in common? Those types of things. So you can build the attributes. And the data tells you what, but people tell you why. So you really do want to follow up with some qualitative discussion around what those harsher realities are. Now, while it might be a harsh reality to one person, it's not a harsh reality to somebody else. So it's the common things are things like working really lean, being a consensus-driven organization where it might take longer to get something done. These are things that are pervasive in certain cultures. But when you ask people, what's like the hardest thing about working here? And people can rattle them off really quick. The important thing to then ask is, well, why do you do it? Why do you stay? And those answers are probably the most important thing to start to articulate, because you can say, the days will be long, you're going to be asked to do a lot with a little, but you're going to be met with the support and the backing and the collaboration of a team that has your back always. And you're going to have the trust to just get on with it and get things done, or whatever those positive sides of the employee experience are. You're then painting a very balanced view. And then the way you start activating that, to start articulating that to candidates on the front end, is really through voice of the associate. It's very rare that you want to have your brand broadcasting these messages. What I like to do is just identify associates that have lived out these examples and help them articulate it. So I give them a microphone. So they're either writing blog posts, they're doing employee-generated video, there's advocacy campaigns. And I'll say, these are the four storylines that we're looking to produce. If you have an experience, please share it with this hashtag. And then people really start to make their own impression about what the brand, what it's like, what that experience feels like.
And I guess, you know, there's a sort of societal or sort of structural shift that's gone on from, you know, when we go and buy something, we do our own research and you look for sort of voice of the customer who've bought the same thing, you're reading reviews and you're doing these own things. You know, no one's just buying something based on the company broadcast description of it anymore, right? We're looking for some firsthand experience. And I think in our own business, we've seen that same thing play out with folks as they're looking to come on board. They do a bunch of their own research and they try to find people who used to work here, and they go to Glassdoor, to your point. And that can be a really powerful thing, I think, if you can harness it. But I also like how you try to get folks to articulate it and try to push that out, so that there are those sort of essentially these like firsthand experiences that are out in the ethosphere, or whatever you want to call it, blogosphere, whatever, for people to kind of grab onto and take a bite of these sample experiences.
The storytelling is my favorite, by far my favorite part. It's the toughest in the beginning, trying to articulate and find them, because people aren't used to talking about the brand in that way, or and sometimes feeling a bit vulnerable and sharing their story. So it can be a bit difficult to get people to open up. But what I find is, after you get the first handful done and out there, the response to them is so positive that it really encourages a lot more to flow freely and much quicker. And every good story has conflict. So finding something that someone had to encounter or face, and then to only talk about what they found on the other side, talking about that in a job description, or having that next to a job description, like, all right, the toughest part about this job is this. Here's what I learned from it. Here's how it helped me get this next job, or helped with my career progression, mobility. That stuff is red. I mean, when you heat map your career right. site, look at the related content around the job descriptions. If you've got those stories there, it is bright red and you're getting so much action on it. And it's the number one most read piece of communication that employer branders put out, and we spend the least amount of time on it.
Isn't that funny?
A lot of hiring managers are responsible for writing their own. Very few people are proud of them. But when you take a different approach and you tell the story of the job, it matters. It can really help influence the quality of applicant coming in, and having people who are really excited about the opportunity feel more informed and more prepared.
Why don't people do it? I mean, it feels like such a bang for your buck thing.
So much work. If you think of most organizations, the volume of job descriptions that they have, and most in my experience, most employers are using them more as a compliance tool than a talent attraction tool. They think of it as a compliance document. And I think the shift of marketing, recruitment marketing, has brought in a new skill set, and we're really starting to look at them. But a company like Danaher, we have 60 to 70,000 associates all over the world. That's a lot of job descriptions to inherit.
It is a lot of job descriptions to inherit. And I think it goes back to this thing that this whole podcast is trying to break. And that is this tendency for, you know, leaders who are maybe more dollar myopic or more sort of dollar focused, who want to have that direct line between investment and return. I get ROI, like obviously that's a part of every business. I get these things, these concepts. But imagine the efficiency that you pick up from a hiring standpoint if these sort of stories are incorporated with this job description that ends up going on, you know, the job hiring site. If it helps you, I mean, even if you can increase your employee tenure by 15 or 20%, even if you can reduce your employee churn by 15 or 20%, those are real dollars on the bottom line, not only from a direct sort of what's the cost to hire somebody explicitly, but also from an efficiency standpoint of not all these people having to go through that J curve of getting on the new job and it taking 9 to 18 months for them to really get their sea legs. Like, you can keep people longer or you have a higher hit rate. Those all feed into the ROI goodness that everybody's looking for, but they don't want to take that next step to add some dimensionality to these job descriptions, because to your point, there's 60,000 of them. Like, that's a big issue, but it just seems like there's so much opportunity in it, you know?
Yeah, and I think another way to look at it is, even if you're not ready to rewrite all your job descriptions, you know, there's always a place to start. You can start by looking at your highest volume or most critical job families and running a little A/B test there to try to get more investment so that you could scale it quickly. And also video. I mean, employee generated video, it's come such a long way, where there's tools like AllTrue where you can just get massive amounts of video for not a lot of money. And if you start just embedding a video job description next to every job description, meet your boss, you get 60 seconds of the boss talking about, hey, this is the challenge this role is going to fill on our team, and here's what we're looking for you to do. You will absolutely see clicks and engagement on that video like you have never seen before.
Isn't that interesting? And to your point, it doesn't need to be some high production value video. I mean, we're beyond that now. I mean, people are watching TikTok videos all the time. You know what I'm saying? 60-second little bites where you can get a taste is going to give us so much more bang for our buck, coupled with the probably reduction in reading that everybody does now, right? Everybody wants to download it quickly. I don't know. I feel like I can go on about this. The light bulbs are going on. Light bulbs are going on for me here, you know?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think the more organic the video is, the better it's going to be. As long as the camera's not shaking and you have good audio. But we all have amazing cameras in our pocket, so using those is the way to go.
Tell us a little bit about Danaher. It's a really interesting organization. It's an organization I really looked up to over the last 20 years or 15 years since I first found out about it. I love what you guys do, but I think you guys have some really interesting challenges in the terms of the way that you guys grow. And I would love you to kind of speak to some of that and talk about how you can incorporate some of this employer branding ethos across these different cultures that end up sort of folding into your organization.
Danaher is an amazing organization. Those that know it really admire their sustainable business results over an extended period of time were a really well-known MBA case study. But Danaher's results are impressive. So over the last 25 years, they've outperformed the S&P 500 by 5,000%. And it's an interesting brand and a hugely complex brand challenge for me because Danaher Corporate is 500 associates. And that's comprised of over 20 different operating companies. And the operating companies all operate independently under their own brand names. So they fall into four different high impact segments. So we have a life sciences portfolio, we have a diagnostics portfolio, we have a product identification portfolio, and water quality. And we grow pretty significantly year over year via a really aggressive M&A strategy. And you might have seen that we just closed the deal on GE Biosciences. Mm-hmm. Biopharma, they just came in. They've been rebranded as Cytiva, which was one of the largest deals, I think the largest deal in the life sciences space to ever close. So that was bringing on, I think, 7,000 people in a really important business. And they're so excited to come to Danaher because Danaher has the secret sauce. They call it the Danaher Business System. Mm-hmm. And it's a system that's really based on continuous improvement. And there's a whole lot of tools and techniques that go into it, but it's really based on the principle of always better, never perfect. And the way that we measure things, the way that we acquire a business and teach them and apply these tools, what we see is a really dramatic return on that those businesses' performance. So that's a really cool thing about Danaher. The other cool thing about Danaher, you might have seen the article on HBR that came out earlier this year. We are known as a stealth CEO factory. And we produce really strong leaders that can deliver crazy business results. And there was a study that came out and it looked at three stealth companies, one of them being Danaher, and measured the performance of the people that left and went on to be a CEO of another business. And they outperformed these three companies, the CEOs combined, outperformed all the other CEOs of the Fortune 500 by like 67%.
Wow.
And we've got a really incredible talent management team that really focuses on career mobility and career impact. I think because the size and scale of Danaher, you have a lot of opportunity to diversify your skill set and move around. You get taught this Danaher business skills. But we promote from within. 75% of our roles need to be filled internally. So we use our UR program as a feeder. Early careers, you're brought in and you're pipelining. All those big major scientific roles and innovations that will come out will be a direct result of the people we're bringing in early. But we like to train people the Danaher way, and we like to give people opportunity, really stretch them in a way that you might think that you only have 20% competency in a given role, and you probably do, and that's good enough for us. We would rather develop and coach and support and give people a huge opportunity in a different area than to hire from the outside.
Their willingness to take you on and kind of run your plays differed from other experiences you've had in other organizations where maybe you didn't have that same kind of opportunity for impact or something?
I don't know. I feel like I've been lucky. Everywhere that I have gone, they hired me to come in and do the work. So I think back to 2010, I had first moved to California from the East Coast and I got a job at Life Technologies. And I was working in an internal communication capacity. That's the first job that came along and said, okay, we've got this need to attract talent differently. You've got a related skill set. You want to get after this. Had so much fun doing it. Well, that company got acquired by Thermo Fisher Scientific. And because I had just built the employer brand there, the head of talent acquisition at Thermo Fisher came from Life Tech. So she said, I'd like you to come on board and build Thermo Fisher's employer brand. So I got to experience and have a lot of empathy for being acquired. Right. And going through that journey, Thermo Fisher gave me everything I needed to do that job right. I mean, they gave me the budget I needed. They gave me the time I needed. And at the time, it was probably the strongest case study that came out on the market about the ROI of building an employer brand. We cut our cost for hire 60%. We improved our quality of hire 40%. The traffic to our sites. But overnight, it took us 18 months and over $1 million of investment to have that impact. The next brand I went to was really a moment of bravery and courage because a lot of people discounted the results I had at Thermo Fisher just based on the amount of resource I had. Most employer brand practitioners are running very lean. They don't have the budget or the team or the luxury of 18 months to build a brand. So I wanted to prove that it didn't take all that and that we could achieve superior results without being held hostage to these agencies that charge us an outrageous amount of money. And so I went to Magellan Health, which is a really small Fortune 500 company. It's a managed healthcare company in the US only. And we built our employer brand in 100 days for $100,000. And the results went on to far surpass anything I had achieved at Thermo Fisher, in part because we applied the give and the get, and I learned this new way of working. But the coolest measure of success for me at Magellan was that it became the corporate brand within 6 months. It's the first Fortune 500 I'm aware of that adopted the employer brand as the corporate brand, because we had come up with a system that was so flexible that it spoke not only to candidates and associates, but also to investors and to members of the healthcare plan with equal strength. And it was a really cool exercise. So by the time I came to Danaher, I just had so much in my head that I wanted to do and so much I had learned from applying different methods to building an employer brand, that I was really looking for an organization that wanted to go on that journey with me and to apply it to some of the most complex businesses I've ever seen. And I certainly don't have all of the answers figured out for how we're going to get after it at Danaher. But there's always been this willingness to use employer brand to better attract, engage, and retain.
I think that's so cool that at Magellan you were able to kind of meld these two sort of public and, you know, private sort of brands. That's a really interesting, it's a really interesting approach, and I bet it was super powerful. And it probably created a lot of feelings of authenticity for somebody coming in and sort of just first experiencing it from, you know, off the jump. So there's two things I want to ask you about. One is, you know, you spoke about how many of the folks that are in your shoes in other organizations, they don't have the budget or the time period and so forth. I think I'm on your team in terms of, I get that this is such a huge opportunity for an organization. It's such a huge opportunity for the bottom line and those sort of tangible results that folks are looking for. What do we do to help elevate people in these types of roles to be unleashed like you've had the opportunity to be unleashed at some of these other organizations? What do we do to turn those light bulbs on at the top? It's very obvious to me, but it's obviously not obvious to everyone because this position isn't everywhere and there's not resources poured into it. And these are the types of positions that get sort of the belt tightened on them. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, the last 12 months has been so encouraging for me to see the number of the influx of new employer brand jobs. And it used to be just large, you know, 10,000 plus organizations had roles like mine. Now we're seeing it at startups, and they're really realizing the impact of employer brand. What we don't see enough of yet is the resource behind the roles.
Right.
So they'll invest in hiring someone, but then they're not given the budget. And what I have found a lot of success in is starting sort of smaller on a talent attraction campaign, where you'll look at one job family that you need to hire and getting a small investment there, and then really demonstrating the impact that campaign had. And once you can demonstrate and report out the results of that, more money tends to flow quicker. The other thing that nobody is prepared for, and that I've encountered 6 out of 6 times in these roles, is the amount of change management and politics that goes along with it. Because you're building this brand for the first time, and there's other skill sets within every company that are marketing and branding and communication related, but they're not necessarily nuanced for employer brand. There tends to be a tug of war between HR and marketing. Employer brand can sit on either, whichever side you sit on, the other side's going to be tugging and fighting with you because you're going through a heavy degree of change. And to navigate those politics when you're early in your career and you haven't encountered it time and time again, it can really throw you off because you're really outnumbered by the budget and resource on the other side, and you're also outnumbered in terms of the seniority of the people that are resisting what you're there to do.
So how do you do it?
That's just the hardest thing that you can deal with. So I strategically align myself. And if you're new to the organization, you have no currency in the bank with anyone. So you're pretty much dead in the water when it comes to influencing people, unless you're a master persuasion. So I align myself with someone who has currency in the bank and with someone who can operate really strategically to help me break down some of those barriers. And I was really deliberate in picking a hiring manager at Danaher that I thought had enough of these skills to help me navigate the waters. And I'm so glad that I did, because even now with all the experience that I've had, I'm still encountering, you know, just resistance to change, driving change in organizations that have worked the same way for many, many years. It doesn't happen overnight. And I think finding people that can help you influence those individuals is really important. And also learning when to give, and, you know, which battles you want to really go to the grave for and which ones you can compromise on is something that didn't come as easy to me when I was younger, that I'm much more able to pick the moments. I think because with experience comes the ability to know what's really going to matter on the back end when you're activating, what's going to hold you back from achieving what you know is possible and what won't, and learning where you can have those compromises. And the most beautiful moment is when, and it always happens, is after some of those difficult conversations early on, you become allies and you really right. start working together and seeing the results that come in. And the work is never as strong without that relationship and that ally.
And then my second question, I love how like actionable that perspective was, because somebody who is just starting, they want to get it all. You know, if you don't know what you don't know what hills you have to die on, then you start spending that currency that you might not have a lot of on battles that are really going to be irrelevant, to your point, for the broader war that you're fighting, right? So I love that, that perspective and the wisdom that was in that. My other question was, this is going to be kind of a weird question. Where's the line between articulating the existing culture, the existing, you know, brand experience, and building that brand experience, which I think is rooted ultimately in culture within the organization? You know what I'm saying?
If we're brands always discipline the reality of the current experience and the aspirations of where you're going in the future. Most people want to join an organization to help you build not where you are today, but where you're going. So just being clear about where you are in your journey and what you need people to do and where you aspire to go. Typically, when you're doing your research on the front end, there's three main views you want to capture. You want to capture the leader view, the workforce view, and then the market view. And speaking to the leaders of a company is really important, because they're a bit removed from the reality of the work experience, but they're really focused on building and hitting those priorities in that five-year plan. That's where you'll tend to capture a lot of the company's aspirations and maybe even some of the skill sets that don't exist on the team today that you need to hire in order to grow and be successful. But they do tend to be a bit removed from the work experience. You can never lead with just those leadership perspectives. You need to blend that with the reality of what it's like today. And you only get that from speaking to folks on the front line who are doing the work day in and day out.
And then when you encounter dissonance between these three different views, is there work that you need to do sort of on the, you know, on the back end, sort of, or on the front end before you sort of go to market with this thing? Or do you just bring that dissonance into the thing that you're going to the market with to kind of show that vulnerability and authenticity in that brand message?
Well, you want to validate that the findings are universal. So you want to make sure they're not isolated. Or you want to segment your marketing strategy so that there's certain messages you're dialing up or dialing down depending on who you're speaking to. So at a large global company, you know, the aspirations might be a bit different in APAC than they are in the US. So you want to note those things. And then you just want to stress test them and make sure that there's something that the organization really wants to go after. The market view is really important, because while something might be a real strength and a real aspiration of your organization, you want to make sure that you're also solving for competitive white space. So if the three companies that you're constantly fighting against for talent are all going to market with the same messaging, although it's true, it's probably not going to set you apart in the way that you want this brand work to do. So you want to look at all three of those things carefully and help identify where the competitive white space lives. So an audit of the competing brands is really helpful. And there's a lot of research partners that can help you do this work. As an employee brand practitioner, don't feel like you have to do this all on your own.
Mm-hmm. That competitive white space piece, I think a lot of people end up missing, and they end up just all kind of sounding the same. And then if there's nothing to differentiate on, then people are going to fill in the gaps with something else. So I think being tuned into that is very important and smart. So I want to be conscious of your time. This has been a great conversation. I could probably keep going on this for another hour or so. Your book is Give and Get. tell us, give us one takeaway from that to really set the hook so that everyone, everyone listening does their required reading and gets the book and listens to it.
Learning the method of give and get for me, as someone who's built employer brands at Fortune 500 companies, this is probably my sixth one. It changed the way that I will approach employer branding forever. It has inspired me to work in new and novel ways, and the results far surpassed the conventional way of working. I'm incredibly motivated to share this method with consumers, with agencies, with everyone in the world, because I'm so proud to be part of this community. And we all, when we find a better mousetrap, we all give it away because we want everyone to achieve more. And I really hope that by learning the lessons from a practitioner's point of view, coupled with a really smart agency perspective, will give you a unique lens that you don't often hear to together about how you can take really smart framework and approach from an agency, but then apply it with a lot of success internally.
Well, I love it. I love the book. Thank you so much for your time. And thanks for joining us on the Ethics Experts today.
Thank you, Nick.
Wow. That was amazing. Thank you so much.
That was, thank you.
You probably do these all the time. You're like a freaking natural.
I don't know about that, but I appreciate it.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. I really learned a lot, and I want to start doing some of this stuff in our own business because I don't know, so many people in our game, they end up just getting like so pigeonholed and they don't get unleashed to really make these sort of indirect actions that lead to the things that really differentiate the company. And there's like all this old school thinking that's still in place that's holding back people like you or in, you know, people like you in other roles and other organizations from really making that impact. So the book is really awesome. I kind of got a little bonus because I got to talk to each one of you guys individually, which is really cool. And I just appreciate you.
Thank you.